Maboff!
My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? Every little bit helps. Well, not every little bit, but most of it. I'm going to be honest. Last Christmas was tough for me. Money was tight, and so my wife and I decided that we wouldn't do presents for one another. The trouble is, I saw the perfect gift for her. A set of antique combs and hair accessories that Bridget could use on her long blonde hair. So I made a difficult choice. I sold the pocket watch my grandfather gave me before he passed away, just so I could buy her those combs. On Christmas Day, I discovered Bridget had found the perfect gift for me, a chain for the beloved Bob watch I just sold. And worse than that, she'd gotten the money by selling her precious hair to a local wig maker. Both the chain and the combs were now useless. Okay, so maybe that story isn't 100% true, starting with the fact that Bridget has red curly hair and hates combs. But you've probably heard the tale before. In fact, the storyline has appeared in over a dozen films, a Broadway musical, and episodes of Futurama, Rugrats, and My Little Pony. But the original tale was written by O. Henry, a short story writer known for twisted tales with ironic endings. And on this week's episode, actor Tosh Greenslade brings to life one of my favourite O. Henry stories. It's a tale of two con artists that might just have been written by a man who was a con man himself. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. O. Henry was born William Sidney Porter in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1862. Before his 30th birthday, the man had worked as a shepherd, a chef, a babysitter, a guitar player, a pharmacist, a journalist, and a banker. There wasn't a job that he wasn't prepared to turn his hand to. He managed to get partially fluent in both German and Spanish, which meant he could talk to almost anyone at any time. But it was in his profession as banker that O. Henry struggled the most. He wasn't a fantastic bookkeeper and was accused of embezzlement by the bank, losing his job and finding himself indicted on federal charges. However, he did skip out on bail, heading to New Orleans and then Honduras, where he spent his time among other exiles, including bank robber Al Jennings. Upon hearing that the wife he had left behind had fallen ill, O. Henry returned to America to see her one last time before she passed away. He was arrested on the spot and spent 3 years in prison. Through all of this, O. Henry wrote short stories, 381 of them in total. And, like O. Henry himself, his characters came from a variety of backgrounds. He made heroes out of con artists and hobos, of criminals and everyday people, showing the creative means with which they solved life's problems, and the cruel twists of fate in store for us all. In The Cop and the Anthem, a New York City hobo decides he's going to get himself arrested and sent to prison so he'll have a warm bed for the night. When no one will arrest him, he stops outside a church where he hears beautiful organ music playing. He's so inspired and moved that he decides to turn his life around, only for him to be sent to prison anyway, for loitering. In A Retrieved Reformation, a safecracker, Jimmy Valentine, finds himself in an ethical dilemma when he has to save a little girl locked in an airtight safe, but in doing so, will have to expose his cover story in the process. O. Henry's twists and turns are not only clever, they work because they understand that the most effective narrative twists are about people. The character's world changes right under their noses, and they never see it coming. O. Henry wasn't interested in fooling the reader, he was interested in confounding his characters. We're just along for the ride. My favourite O. Henry book is The Gentle Grafter, a collection of short stories about a con artist by the name of Jeff Peters and his sometimes partner, Andy Tucker. The stories follow Jeff and Andy on their adventures as they scam, swindle, and flim-flam their way around the American South. What works about these tales is that he doesn't stick to a formula. Sometimes the con artists win, sometimes the suckers get the upper hand, and sometimes fate intervenes and the con artists learn a lesson about life. In the second story of the book, our hero, Jeff Peters, tries his hand at becoming a snake oil salesman and meets Andy Tucker for the first time. Read by Tosh Greenslade, this is Jeff Peters as Personal Magnet by O. Henry.
Jeff Peters has been engaged in as many schemes for making money as there are recipes for cooking rice in Charleston, South Carolina. Best of all, I like to hear him tell of his earlier days, when he stole liniments and cough cures on street corners, living hand to mouth, heart to heart with the people, throwing heads or tails with fortune for his last coin. I struck Fisher Hill, Arkansas, in a buckskin suit, moccasins, long hair, and a 30-carat diamond ring that I got from an actor in Texarkana. I don't know what he ever did with the pocket knife I swapped him for it. I was Dr. Wahoo, the celebrated Indian medicine man. I carried only one best bet just then, and that was resurrection bitters. It was made of life-given plants and herbs accidentally discovered by Ta-Ka-La, the beautiful wife of the chief of the Choctaw Nation, while gathering truck to garnish a platter of boiled dog for the annual corn dance. Business hadn't been good in the last town, so I only had $5. I went to the Fisher Hill druggist, and he credited me for half a gross of my 8-ounce bottles and corks. I had the labels and ingredients in my valise left over from the last town. Life began to look rosy again after I got in my hotel room with the water running from the tap and a resurrection bitters lining up on the table by the dozen. Fake? No, sir. There was $2 worth of fluid extract of cinchona and a dime's worth of aniline in that half gross of bitters. I've gone through towns years afterwards and had folks ask for 'em again. I hired a wagon that night and commenced selling the bitters on Main Street. Fisher Hill was a low, malarial town, and the compound hypothetical pneumocardiac antiscorbutic tonic was just what I diagnosed the crowd as needing. The bitters started off like sweetbreads on toast at a vegetarian dinner. I'd sold 2 dozen at 50 cents apiece when I felt somebody pull my coattail. I knew what that meant, so I climbed down and sneaked a $5 bill into the hand of a man with a German silver star on his lapel. "Constable," says I, "it's a fine night. Have you got a city license," he asks, "to sell this illegitimate essence of spooju that you flatter by the name of medicine?" "I have not," says I. "I didn't know you had a city. If I can find it tomorrow, I'll take one out if it's necessary." "I'll have to close you up till you do," says the constable. I quit selling and went back to the hotel. I was talking to the landlord about it. "Oh, you won't stand no show in Fisher Hill," says he. "Dr. Hoskins, the only doctor here, is a brother-in-law of the mayor, and they won't allow no fake doctor to practice in this town." "I don't practice medicine," says I. "I've got a state peddler's license, and I take out a city one wherever they demand it." I went to the mayor's office the next morning, and they told me he hadn't showed up yet. They didn't know when he'd be down. So Doc Wahoo haunches down again in a hotel chair and lights a gypsum weed regalia and waits. By and by, a young man in a blue necktie slips into the chair next to me and asks the time. 10:30, says I, "and you are Andy Tucker. I've seen you work. Wasn't it you that put up the Great Cupid combination package on the Southern States? Let's see, it was a Chilean diamond engagement ring, a wedding ring, a potato masher, a bottle of soothing syrup, and Dorothy Vernon. All for 50 cents. Andy was pleased to hear that I remembered him. He was a good street man, and he was more than that. He respected his profession, and he was satisfied with 300% profit. He had plenty of offers to go into the illegitimate drug and garden seed business, but he was never to be tempted off the straight path. I wanted a partner, so Andy and me agreed to go out together. I told him about the situation in Fisher Hill and how finances was low on account of the local mixture of politics and jalap. Andy had just got in on the train that morning. He was pretty low himself and was going to canvass the whole town for a few dollars to build a new battleship by popular subscription at Eureka Springs. So we went out and sat on the porch and talked it over. The next morning at 11 o'clock, I was sitting there alone, and Uncle Tom shuffles into the hotel and asks for the doctor to come and see Judge Banks, who, it seems, was the mayor and a mighty sick man. "I'm no doctor," says I. "Why don't you go and get the doctor?" "Boss," says he, "Dr. Hoskins am done gone 20 miles in the country to see some sick persons. He the only doctor in the town, and Massa Banks am powerful bad off. He sent me to ax you please, sir, come." "As man to man," says I, "I'll go and look him over." So I put a bottle of resurrection bitters in my pocket and goes up on the hill to the mayor's mansion, the finest house in town, with a mannered roof and 2 cast-iron dogs on the lawn. This Mayor Banks was in bed all but his whiskers and feet. He was making internal noises that would have had everybody in San Francisco hiking for the pox. A young man was standing by the bed holding a cup of water. "Doc," says the mayor, "I'm awful sick. I'm about to die. Can't you do nothing for me?" "Mr. Mayor," says I, "I'm not a regular preordained disciple of S.Q. Lapius. I never took a course in medical college," says I. "I've just come as a fellow man to see if I could be of assistance." "I'm deeply obliged," says he. "Doc Wahoo, this is my nephew, Mr. Biddle. He has tried to alleviate my distress, but without success." "Oh, Lordy! Ow, ow, ow!" he sings out. I nods at Mr. Biddle and sits down by the bed and feels the mayor's pulse. "Let me see your liver, your tongue, I mean," says I. Then I turns up the lids of his eyes and looks close at the pupils of him. "How long have you been sick?" I asked. "I was taken down now, ow, ouch, last night," says the mayor. "Give me something for it, Doc, won't you?" "Mr. Fiddle," says I, "raise the window shade a bit, would you?" "Biddle," says the young man, "do you feel like you could eat some ham and eggs, Uncle James?" "Mr. Mayor," says I, after laying my ear to his right shoulder blade and listening, "you've got a bad attack of superinflammation of the right clavicle of the harpsichord." "Good Lord," says he with a groan, "can't you rub something on it or set it or anything?" I picks up my hat and I starts for the door. "You ain't going, Doc," says the mayor with a howl. "You ain't going away and leave me to die with this superfluity of the clapboards, are you?" "Common humanity, Dr. Woha," says Mr. Biddle, "ought to prevent you from deserting a fellow human in distress." "Dr. Wahoo, when you get through plowing," says I. And then I walks back to the bed and throws back my long hair. "Mr. Mayor," says I, "there is only one hope for you. Drugs will do you no good. But there is another power higher yet, although drugs are high enough," says I. "And what is that?" says he. "Scientific demonstration," says I. "The triumph of mind over sarsaparilla. The belief that there is no pain and sickness except what is produced when we ain't feeling well. Declare yourself in arrears. Demonstrate." "What is this paraphernalia you speak of, Doc?" says the mayor. "You ain't a socialist, are you?" "I am speaking," says I, "of the great doctrine of psychic financiering, of the enlightened school of long-distance, subconscientious treatment of fallacies and meningitis, of that wonderful indoor sport known as personal magnetism." "Can you work it, Doc?" says the mayor. "I am one of the sole sanderims of the ostensible hooplas of the inner pulpit," says I. "The lame talk and the blind rubber whenever I make a pass at 'em. I am a medium, a coloratura, a hypnotist, and a spirituous control. It was only through me at the recent seances at Ann Arbor that the late president of the Vinegar Bitters Company could revisit the earth to communicate with his sister Jane. You see me peddling medicine on the street," says I, "to the poor. I don't practice personal magnetism on them. I do not drag it in the dust," says I, "because they haven't got the dust. Will you treat my case?" says the mayor. "Listen," says I, "I've had a good deal of trouble with medical societies everywhere I've been. I don't practice medicine. But to save your life, I'll give you the psychic treatment if you'll agree, as mayor, not to push the license question." "Of course I will," says he. "And now get to work, Doc, for them pains are coming on again." "My fee will be $250. Cure guaranteed in 2 treatments, says I. "All right," says the mayor. "I'll pay it. I guess my life's worth that much." I sat down by the bed and looked him straight in the eye. "Now," says I, "get your mind off the disease. You ain't sick. You haven't got a heart or a clavicle or a funny bone or brains or anything. You haven't got any pain. Declare error. Now you feel the pain that you didn't have leaving, don't you?" "I do feel some little better, Doc," says the mayor. "Darned if I don't. Now state a few lies about my not having this swelling on my left side, and I think I could be propped up and have some sausage and buckwheat cakes." I made a few passes with my hands. "Now," says I, "the inflammation's gone. The right lobe of the perihelion has subsided. You're getting sleepy. You can't hold your eyes open any longer. For the present, this disease is checked. Now you are asleep. The mayor shuts his eyes slowly and begins to snore. You observe, Mr. Tittle, says I, the wonders of modern science. Biddle, says he. When will you give Uncle the rest of the treatment, Dr. Poo-Poo? Wahoo, says I. I'll come back at 11 tomorrow. When he wakes up, give him 8 drops of turpentine and 3 pounds of steak. Good morning. The next morning, I was back on time. Well, Mr. Riddle, says I, when he opened the bedroom door, how is Uncle this morning? He seems much better, says the young man. The mayor's color and pulse was fine. I gave him another treatment, and he said that the last of the pain had left him. Now, says I, you'd better stay in bed for a day or two, and you'll be all right. It's a good thing I happen to be in Fisher Hill, Mr. Mayor, says I. For all the remedies in the cornucopia that the regular schools of medicine use couldn't have saved you. And now that error has flew and pain proved a perjurer, let's allude to a cheerfuler subject. Say, the fee of $250? No checks, please. I hate to write my name on the back of a check almost as bad as I do the front. I've got the cash here, says the mayor, pulling a pocketbook from under his pillow. He counts out 5 $50 notes and holds them in his hand. Bring the receipt, he says to Biddle. I signed the receipt and the mayor handed me the money. I put it in my inside pocket, careful. Now do your duty, officer, says the mayor, grinning much unlike a sick man. Mr. Biddle lays his hand on my arm. You are under arrest, Dr. Wahoo, alias Peters, says he, for practicing medicine without authority under state law. Who are you, I asks. I'll tell you who he is, says the mayor, sitting up in his bed. He's a detective employed by the State Medical Society. He's been following you over 5 counties. He came to me yesterday and we fixed up this scheme to catch you. I guess you won't be doing any more doctoring around these parts, Mr. Fake here. What was it you said I had, Doc? The mayor laughs. Compound? Well, it wasn't softening up the brain, I guess, anyway. A detective, says I. Correct, says Biddle. I'll have to turn you over to the sheriff. Let's see you do it, says I, and grabs Biddle by the throat and half throws him out the window. But he pulls a gun and sticks it under my chin and I stand still. Then he puts handcuffs on me and takes the money out of my pocket. I witness, says he, that they're the same bank bills that you and I marked, Judge Banks. I'll turn them over to the sheriff when we get to his office and he'll send you a receipt. They'll have to be used as evidence in the case. Well, all right, Mr. Biddle, says the mayor. And now, Doc Wahoo, he goes on, why don't you demonstrate? Can't you pull the cork out of your magnetism with your teeth and hocus-pocus them handcuffs off? Come on, officer, says I, dignified. I may as well make the best of it. And then I turns to old Banks and rattles my chains. Mr. Mayor, says I, the time will come soon when you'll believe that personal magnetism is a success, and then you'll be sure that it succeeded in this case, too. And I guess it did. When we got nearly to the gate, I says, we might meet somebody now, Andy. I reckon you better take him off and... Hey! Why, of course it was Andy Tucker. That was his scheme. And that's how we got the capital to go into business together.
That was Jeff Peters as Personal Magnet by O. Henry, read by Tosh Greenslade. What did you think? Did you see the twist coming? Or was it obvious a mile away? Or does it even really matter? I'd love to hear what you think. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this has been Scammapalooza.